You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer.
Hey, everybody. So social media is all the rage, and everybody wants to know how to use it to sell tickets. Well, I'm teaching a webinar next Wednesday, April 6th at 7 p.m. Eastern, all about how to use social media to sell tickets for your show. Get all the details on theproducersperspective.com, and if you're a pro member, you get this webinar for free. Now, on with the podcast.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Ken Davenport here. This is the Producer's Perspective podcast, and I've taken the show on the road today. We're podcasting from Brooklyn, which I will be honest, I've lived in New York 20 years. I've only been here like three times. We're recording this session from the studio of today's guest. Welcome to the podcast, EGOT winner Robert Lopez. Welcome, Bobby.
Hey, thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me.
So Bobby really needs no intro, but in case you've been living under a musical theater rock for the past decade, he's responsible for some of the most unique and successful shows on Broadway. One of the co-creators of Avenue Q, Tony Award for Best Musical and Score, Book of Mormon, Tony Award Best Musical Score and Best Book as well, and a Grammy Award. Television contributed songs to Wonder Pets, Emmy Award, as well as Scrubs, The Simpsons, a lot more. And with his wife, Kristen, he wrote the songs for Frozen, including the song heard around the world as sung by every child under the age of 10, Let It Go, which is when he won that Oscar and Emmy plus Grammy plus Oscar plus Tony equals EGOT. The quickest person in history to rack up all four. Okay, Bobby. So that's where we are today. How did you get started in writing for the theater?
I kind of got the bug really early. I grew up in Manhattan, and I was in this drama group. Before that, I started taking piano lessons. I was 7 years old, and my piano teacher had me write little pieces, and I started writing songs at seven. And all my teachers knew that I was musical, and we did... I was in this drama group in Greenwich Village, and the teacher said, you know, would you like to write the opening number of our show? It was a little student-written show. It was kind of like chorus line, but kids auditioning for a performing arts-type high school. It was like Chorus Line meets Fame. And I said, sure, yeah, I'd love to do that. And I wrote a number, and that was the end of it. I loved doing that, and everyone said what a great number it was, and I had the bug. I never looked back.
Do you remember what it was about writing that piece or seeing it up that made you go, oh, the theater, that's what I want to write for? You could have written for pop music, for singers, for anything. But why the theater?
I don't know what it was. I think I just I enjoyed – I was a shy kid. And I think a lot of artistic kids, a lot of kids who compose and play piano are, you know, they tend to be a little bit shy. And music was my way of sort of coming alive in a group. And I think that's what it was, that I got to be on stage and be extroverted and be and sing and tell jokes and you know, and then through composing and songwriting, I could sort of show that off at the same time. And it was kind of like a kid that kept to himself getting to finally show off once in a while and having a convention that made it okay and bridged the boundaries that shyness kind of put up.
This is where I sometimes ask my composer guests about their first song, but you talked a lot about your first composition or early composition on your TEDx Broadway talk, which is amazing. So we're just going to put a link to that in the blog about this, which is great. Then you went to Yale, right?
Uh-huh.
And what did you major in at Yale?
I majored in English. I got a BA in English. And I actually it was a double major. I majored in music too. But I think when you double major, it only one of them counts. So that's the one.
And did you know you wanted to compose for the theater when you went to Yale?
I did. And I went to Yale because, it's funny, the day that I met Stephen Sondheim when I was 15 years old, I knew someone that knew him, and I got, through that person, I got him a tape, and he wrote me back a letter, as he does to so many young composers, so generously and gives of his time. And it was an encouraging letter, and I just felt like, wow, I could really do this. And then the friend said, would you like to meet him? I said, yes. So, I went up to, he was recording an interview with James Lapine at, in Manhattan somewhere. And it was part of the Into the Woods, question and answer kind of portion of the MTI videotape. And so I was there that day that they taped it. And so was David Pogue, who was this Yalie, who now is famous for his Apple reviews, from the Times and Yahoo, whatever. And he was the one who said, if you're going to go to college, you've got to go to Yale. Adam Gettle was at Yale. You know, that's the place, you know, you're gonna, have your work done as much as you want. Basically, there's so many theaters, just doing student written stuff. So that's why I went there.
So after school, you just picked up though and got on the Metro North and moved to New York?
Yeah. Well, I was from New York, so I moved right back in with my parents. It was, quite as simple as that.
And so tell me your first show, you kind of burst on the scene with Avenue Q, but tell me a little bit about how it was born.
I was, one of the first things I did when I graduated Yale, and this is something that I tell everyone that asks me for advice, is I auditioned for the BMI workshop, BMI Musical Theater Workshop. And it was this great, it's a class, it's still being done, it's stronger than ever now, and it's free, it's for anyone that auditions and gets in, and it's a place where you can, A, kind of learn the professional jargon and the craft of musical theater writing, and it's also, but even more than that, it's a place where you can meet collaborators, you can have an audience for your early work. You can find out what's going on in the scene of your generation, basically, and that's what it was for me. And that's where I met Jeff Marks, and we started writing we together. I was actually writing by myself to begin with. I was writing music and lyrics, and I noticed that I wasn't having as much fun as most of the other people in the class because they were all meeting each other and finding times to write together. And I just realized, like, I'm kind of just sort of sitting in my parents' house with headphones on writing songs. So I called up Jeff, who had written this great song called People Suck. And it made me laugh, made the whole class laugh. And I said, we want to write together. So we ended up writing a little show. And our first project, we ended up doing a teeny show and then a bigger show called Kermit, Prince of Denmark. We had to do an adaptation. So we decided to do Hamlet as done by the Muppets. And it was all about Kermit the Frog was on a plane to Denver and got on the wrong plane to Denmark. And chaos ensued. Anyway, so that's how we got puppets. That's how we got the idea for doing puppets. And we met Rick Lyon. And I remember I was sitting once again in my parents' place with like my third scotch at 1 a.m. thinking, how the hell am I going to get out of here? and it hit me. I was looking at the TV. I was like, what about a TV show? It's like Sesame Street meets Friends. And I called Jeff. It was like 1 or 2 a.m. And he was like, yeah, let's do that. So that's how that was born.
So we'll flash forward a bit. Actually, Robin Goodman was on last week's episode, so she talked a little bit about the change from television to theater. So it opens off Broadway, and then it gets people think around town, oh, what a great off-Broadway show. It'll probably sit there, and then Kevin and Jeffrey and Robin move it to Broadway, and all of a sudden, it's this big hit. You were living in your parent. Were you still living in your parents' house when you...
No, I moved out like the month that we signed the deal with Jeffrey and Kevin and Robin. I moved. It was right after 9/11 too. It was like nine. It was 10/11. 10/11/01.
So this little show opens big. What was going through your mind when the night of the Tony Awards? Could you ever have imagined this little show born in your parents' house would ever have achieved what it did?
Yeah, no. I mean, that was the crazy thing. I never imagined Broadway success. I just always imagined, off-Broadway failure. I always thought, if I could just get a failure off-Broadway, that'll be something. So that was my goal. And somehow... Somehow
you failed. That's other, your goal,
I failed at my goal. Yeah.
I'm so sorry to tell you.
I wanted to write something that was very admired but didn't run very long off Broadway.
Okay, so Avenue Q is a big hit, and then we go on your next show. You start writing Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. How did you? Was there a lot of pressure on you when you started writing that show? Did you feel more pressure, less pressure?
It was for fun. In a lot of ways, it was for fun because I was writing with these giants in my life. Matt and Trey were a huge inspiration. They had just come out with South Park the year I graduated. So that completely, they were sort of heroes. And I didn't, for a lot of it, I was kind of thinking like, they're just screwing around. I don't think they really care. I don't think they really want to do this, but we're having fun. And I get to, go to LA and meet them. And then it sort of started to every time we would meet, we would write some songs, and then the songs would still be good and they'd still want to work on it. So over the course of a few years, we assembled enough to do a reading. And that's when it started to gain some momentum. And we did a reading at the Vineyard Theater, which is where we had done Avenue Q, in 2008, I think. And that's when it started to be like, oh, this could be a show. This could be my next show.
But interestingly enough, just like Hugh, as you were creating, you weren't thinking, oh, Broadway is where we'll be.
No, I mean, I think, and not only that, we weren't even sure it was a theater piece. We were kind of writing it as an album. We were sort of writing these songs. We would write notes on what the story was, and then Trey would always lose the note cards every time. and we'd get together the next 6 months later, and we'd be like, oh, so what's the story again? Shit, Trey lost the note card. So what's it? Oh, yeah. And then we talk and we say like, we already figured this out. Wait a minute. and so finally, we committed some stuff to paper, and we still thought they weren't sure if they wanted to stay with what they knew and do a movie, or if they wanted to sort of be adventurous and do it on stage. I'm glad we did it on stage. But we still have that urge to maybe see it as a movie one day.
I just love that you committed it to paper. No one picked up a laptop and put it in there so you wouldn't lose that.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I think we probably committed it to a laptop.
And what's your approach in general with the collaborative process? You work with Jeff Marks. You're working by yourself first in your room with your headphones. Then mm-hmm. You're working with Jeff, a student, a peer. Then you're working with these giants of comedy. What is your approach to the collaborative process for writing a musical? Are you a music, lyrics? And I notice on a lot of your shows, you're just listed on Book of Mormon specifically. It's just the three of you, right? Yeah. It's not music, lyrics, book.
Yeah, I love the more, the less definition between the roles. I get off on that. I like, obviously, like I started as a lyricist and a composer mixed together, and I always feel stifled if I can't write lyrics. So I've never worked with anyone as purely a composer, or maybe I have, but no, just not that much. I just like an open atmosphere. I like not feeling too precious about things. I like when my collaborators are allowed to say, I don't like that melody. What if it went like this? Can you change the bass line there? I like that. I like that it takes it away from preciousness and ego and brings it toward the realm of what's going to connect with people. What is going to speak to people? Because I think that in the end, that's really what I want to do. I don't want to write stuff that's sort of ethereal and admired. I really do like to connect with an audience.
And that went both ways when writing Book of Mormon. So you were saying to Trey and Matt, like, you know what would be funny here? This would...
Oh, yeah. I mean, we all wrote all of it. It wasn't... I think because they're so famous and because they're so charismatic, they are perceived... And because we advertise the show as South Park, South Park, South Park, they are perceived as... having come up with the idea and being responsible for a lot of the content, but it was a equal collaboration between us all. And, I came up with Hasadiga Ibawai, you know, which is the song you would think that they wrote, and vice versa. There's lots of stuff that I had less to do with and they had more to do with it. You would think that I did. It was a lot of making each other laugh. And it's funny, we just celebrated the show's 5th anniversary on Broadway, and we spent some time together in a room talking about, you know, what the next things might be. And we were sort of, it was this rhythm kind of came back that felt very familiar of talking, laughing, and then all of a sudden we're all on our phones. And then someone says the next thing, talking, laughing. It was this cool familiar dynamic that reappeared.
So when you say talk about next things for Mormon or another show for the three of you?
Yeah, I mean, well, it was mostly just they were in town, we were having a party, we were doing some press for Australia, and we wanted to have a creative session to see what would happen.
And what about, so you like to collaborate early with your fellow writers. What about directors? Do you like when they come in early? Do you like them to wait for a while? You worked with Jason on Cue and then Casey Nicola, of course.
Directors are really important. I mean, Jason, I can't say enough about Jason. We never really talk about him with what he did with Avenue Q, but Jason was the last of the four of us to come on board, but he was the one to kind of marshal these forces that were kind of, we were like a train that was pulling several different ways. It's with like three locomotives. And he got us all rowing in the same direction towards a goal. And even though I would say that the end product definitely reflected what we wanted, it was Jason that got it there because he was the one that knew where we should head. And if he hadn't come on pretty early, we probably would have spun out. And the same thing, Casey really took Mormon in a way different direction than it had been going in. His influence was kind of huge. The perception of Mormon as this big dancing traditional musical is a lot due to Casey's work. I mean, the dance arrangements and the dance breaks that he put in there and that Glenn, they all had to work with the comedy that we set up. A lot of the show became what it was in Casey's workshop.
And what do you think about the role of the producer on Broadway and in the development of new musicals? You worked with some very different producers, Kevin Jeffrey Robin to Scott Rudin, now to Disney, of course. Uh-huh. What's that like for you? What kind of support do you like? What's a good producer to you?
I've been really lucky. I mean, I think they're all in their way the best that I've gotten to work with. And I think my favorite dynamic is that they're there when you need them. When in the development anyway, that if you need a workshop or a reading, they're able to make it happen, that they're able to challenge you to go beyond what you think is possible. They're able to give notes, but not expect you, not force you to follow them to the letter, that they'll understand if you try and hear the problem behind the note and address that, that they're not prescriptive of how the plot should go or whatever. So it's, and that they be brave, that they be risk takers. I think a lot of writers are risk takers. I know I'm a risk taker, but I'm also profoundly conservative with my money, and like, you know, I could never write a check the way producers do on something challenging and something that it could just be a waste of money. So I think it's that sort of, you know, risk-taking, gambling, high-risk, high-reward attitude that they need to provide the bravery for it. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the different strengths and weaknesses, I mean, you know, Rudin is so smart at story math, and he's so good at getting you to put in 150%. And I think Jeffrey and Kevin know a lot about the soul of musical theater, just having been there for Rent and Avenue Q and Hamilton and all these amazing shows that they've done. They just know, they have a lot of wisdom about what makes a show, what makes a good original musical. Robin too, she's been there through so much of it. So I don't know. I've been really, and you for Avenue Q, you know, keeping Avenue Q going for an ungodly amount of time. It's like Lord Voldemort Horcrux time. I don't know how we're doing it, but
we're grinding it out over there.
Seriously.
I find it interesting. You said you know don't understand how producers can write a check or raise money because it's so risky, but you don't see any risk in creating something and putting up in front of people and letting thousands of people judge it. Is that scary for you when the curtain goes up the first time on something that you've created?
Yeah, it's the scariest. It is super scary, and I don't mean to say that we're not risk takers. I just meant risk takers as financial entities and as you know, like I like my stuff to be where it is. I like to know how much I have, all that stuff. I'm not a big better. But producers have to think like, okay, if I risk this, so what? But if it comes back, I can really get a lot out of it. And that's how they have to be. But anyway, yeah, I mean, it's an emotional risk. It's a risk of putting in a lot of time to something and maybe not seeing anything happen, you know, but, it's only yourself that you're putting into it. It's not your stuff. And for me, the thing that I love about it, about Avenue Q and Mormon and Frozen, is that we've put something together that really hasn't been seen before, and we don't know how anyone's going to react because it's never really been done before. And it's almost like a weird social science experiment that you're conducting. And opening night, or the first preview, is really the test case. And I mean, with Book of Mormon, it was so electric. It was so cool that no one knew what was in the show. And the reaction we got was just I'll never forget how electric it was. Same thing with Avenue Q. It was pretty, people were not expecting it. And I love when something new kind of hits an audience. It's also, I'm also pacing in the back, and with Avenue Q, I was at the bar all the time. I'm not a big drinker, but I was just always there, you know, during those months, because I did not enjoy previews. We had a show this summer that was just up here at La Jolla, and that was just a tryout, but it just put us through so much stress. The amount of just adrenaline and worry and fear that goes through you when you're seeing your work up for the first time.
Or do you find yourself, are you a fast writer or slow? Do you love to write? Like, I'm sitting in your office, which you have just to write. Do you wake up like, I'm going to rush to the, or are you a procrastinator? Like, which
I'm not. Yeah, we can't be procrastinators anymore because I write a lot now with Kristen, my wife, and we are basically together all the time. But if we want to be working, we have to use the hours that we have well, and we have a lot to do. So we've turned into really kind of 9 to 5 or 10 to 6 writers, and you know, we're always thinking about it. We think about it in the shower. We think about it, you know, while we're reading books, like, oh my God, you know, I just solved it, or whatever. Kristen is always, we even have like a little notepad in the shower that is waterproof, and there's like a pencil that's waterproof.
I have the same
one. You have the same one?
Yes, I do. One of my staff members gave it to me.
It's useful, right?
It is very useful. Beats writing in fog in the shower door. How is writing with your wife? A lot of people would say, I will never want to work. My wife actually lives in Los Angeles, so we don't see each other. We see each other every couple of weeks. You guys live together, work together, raise kids together.
Yeah.
How is that? Obviously, it's been successful.
It's been successful, and it's, you know, I think it's essential to who we are. I met her at BMI as well, and we started dating first before we started writing together. But it quickly became sort of part of who we were as a couple, even though it wasn't the major focus until, I'd say, like 4 years ago. What we share together, I think, as a result of both being writers and writing together is so much. We're really, you know, we communicate so intimately about so many things during the day. We have the opposite problem of most married couples who are like ships passing in the night. Sometimes they don't see each other because one, you know, one takes over when the other one, gets a rest. You know, we're full in partners, and it's a lot of good. And then when things don't go well, when we're both up, it's great. When one of us is up and the other is down, that's fine because we the other one brings the other one up. But when we're both down, it can be challenging because then who's going to bring us up? You know, it just feels like everything has collapsed. But, That's been rare. Like, we've been pretty lucky.
So let's talk a little bit about Frozen and, of course, the big song Let It Go. And what I'm most curious about is when you finished that song, when you two were done, did you know what it would become? Were you like, this is a good one. We got a good one here. This is going to go far.
Yeah, I think we did. I think we didn't know. We had, obviously, you never know. You always have a good feeling about anything that you want to share with people, otherwise you wouldn't want to share it with them. But we had this feeling of like, well, this is sort of a big song, big emotional song that we weren't even expecting to get to write in this movie, this princess movie. But it was a change of pace for me, for sure, of being able to write this emo kind of ballad that that was about empowerment and really doesn't have much irony to it. You know, it has little ironic moments and all that, but it's not, there's nothing tongue in cheek about it. And it was a first for me, actually. I've been thinking back, like, I really hadn't gotten to write that kind of song ever. Even when I was a kid, I would write these little ironic, sometimes poignant, wry, I don't know, every adjective, but, empowered and, bearing one's soul, and so it was a fun change of pace for me, and I knew that that it was catchy, and it all basically after that it all came down to, well, will the movie be good? Will the movie earn this moment? And the answer for most of the time that we were working on the movie was no. It never. I mean, everyone recognized that's a good song, but no one bought it until very towards the end of the process of making Frozen.
How do you think Broadway is doing today? If it was a patient in a hospital, as I often say, would it be critical condition? Would it be doing well, ready for release?
Seems like it's not in the hospital to me. It seems like it's put on its shoes and it's in its apartment. It's fine. I think it's great. I mean, looking at Hamilton and I don't remember a show in my entire life that has cause as much of a stir as Hamilton has. And I think that Fun Home is equally as exciting, although to me, I feel like Hamilton seems to have covered up the excitement that is Fun Home, too. That I found that show so moving and so different. I think of them both as real pillars of this new age on Broadway.
Looking at all the songs that you've written, I'm going to ask a very dark question now. If you had to put one in a time capsule, as if the world was going to be destroyed tomorrow, but this would exist for future generations to see, what song of yours would you put in? This is a derivative of my Smithsonian question I used to ask, but I'm shaking it up. What song of yours would you put in there?
Oh, gee, I don't know. You know, there's a song that hasn't come out yet, and I can't even tell you what it's in.
We won't tell anybody.
Yeah. just the thousands of subscribers. It's a song that no one's heard yet. So that makes me happy that I still have something. I wrote it, Kristen and I wrote it right around the same time we wrote Let It Go, but it won't come out until next year. So I have that to look forward to.
Do you get writer's block? Do you get stuck like that and think, oh God, I don't know if I can do another Let It Go or I have another big one in me?
Yeah, all the time. That's a constant dialogue that you're having with yourself of like, I don't know if I can do it again. What if I never write another good one, etc. But you learn to, you evolve routines and habits and therapy and just talking. And I think once, the more you write on a routine, the less that seems to be a problem. I think a lot of people have said that too.
Favorite song that you haven't written? Someone else, you know, this is a question that Sondheim was famously asked.
Yeah, and I wrote a song called I Wish That I Had Written Something Sondheim Wished He'd Written. Kristen and I wrote for the roundabout 80th birthday concert. That's a good song. I don't know. Let's see. Lately... Gee, that's too many. That's too much pressure. I mean, even Sondheim realized there was a lot of destruction spread by that list. I don't know. God Only Knows by Brian Wilson. That's the best.
You think it's easier today for new writers to break into this business or harder?
I think it's good. I think it's hard. It's never been easy. But I think there's more attention being paid to musicals than I can remember in my lifetime. You know, when I was graduating, not a lot of people were banging down anyone's door to write anything. Certainly not mine. And there was also this feeling of like, oh, Broadway's a little dusty. And now there's this feeling of freshness that it's this youthful thing and young people are doing it. And so I feel like it can't have gotten any harder because there's more opportunities and there's more belief that the form can show fresh things. So I'm going to say it's easier. I don't know. Easier for me than it used to be.
So when I came in the door here, I said, oh, it's been a long day for you. And you were like, yeah, I've been working. And then I went back to have dinner with my kids. You have two children, right?
Two daughters, yeah.
How do you juggle family with all of this? Like,
a lot of help, a lot of support. And also, like, the best wife and mom ever. I mean, she just, it would all collapse without her. I do stuff and I'm playing a supporting role compared to what she does. She's got the matrix in her mind, you know, she's plugged into it. And we have great caregivers. We have a great school. We have this wonderful school that the girls are in and, great family and it's still hard. It's still really hard.
How old are the kids now?
They're 10 and 6.
Was Frozen the first show of yours or the first piece of yours that they could actually see, were allowed to see because of the material in Q and Mormon?
I think Winnie the Pooh would be closer to that because that came out a little earlier. But we also did, I brought when I thought Avenue Q was closing on Broadway forever, I brought Katie, who was then four, to see it. And the funny thing was I kept taking her out and then bringing her back, taking her out, bringing her back. And then for Act Two, I just sort of sat there with her and watched the whole thing. And then I realized that's what's wrong with Act Two.
I love it. So what's next? Obviously, Frozen announced coming to Broadway. You told me earlier that this is something you're working on right now. Is that the only thing you're doing right now? What's next for you?
Well, we have, there's stuff we can't talk about. We're also doing Gigantic, which is a movie that was announced for Disney. It's a Jack and the Beanstalk retelling, and it's animated. It's a musical, same like Frozen. And we're doing Frozen 2. And then there's another thing we're doing, but really what we have to focus on right now with the schedule that's been handed to us by Disney is Frozen Broadway, which is such a major, I didn't even really quite realize what a huge undertaking that would be. Because we didn't have, first of all, we've been talking about it for a couple of years, but, we only really started writing songs in September, and we have to basically have them all done tomorrow. tomorrow really is the last, is kind of our last day before everything needs to be drafted. I kind of in the back of my mind, when they started talking about Frozen Broadway, I thought 3 songs, 5 songs, maybe, I don't know, what would it need? And then when we got into it, and if you look at The Lion King, for example, these movies have, you can count them on your hands how many songs they have in them, and it's usually somewhere between 5 and 10. It's never 10. Like, it's really, really less than 10. And on Broadway, I always thought, well, it's more like 15 songs on Broadway, but it's really more like 20. 20, 22, counting the little ones and the big ones, and the reprises and all that. It's a far more musical medium, the stage, than cartoon musical fantasy adventure, because you don't have the benefit of close-ups or action on stage so much. You could do on stage, you're really talking about emotion, stories told through song and emotion, and while the plot is happening, information is not as important. Events are not as important on stage. They jump over a big ravine and something, important thing falls into the ravine. Like, that's not really something that registers on stage, or, the people traveling on stage doesn't register as much as it does in a movie where you believe they're traveling. So much of what we're doing is taking cinematic moments and turning them into songs, basically, and communicating the same story through songs. And it's a lot of songs. It's like 15 songs, 12 songs, something like that, depending how you count. Frozen only has 7.
See, that's so interesting, because I think for me and for most people out there, they're like, oh, they're doing Frozen on Broadway. It'll be done in like a month. Why are they waiting a year?
They're doing Frozen at Disneyland, right? They're doing at the Hyperion Theater in Disneyland. And we went to we're not writing anything for that. But the show only needs to be 45 minutes or 50 minutes or something like that. And we watched it, and they didn't omit anything that we wrote. All the songs were in it. And it was a beautiful, cozy 45-minute, perfect 45 minutes. Then we realized, holy shit, we have a lot of stuff to write. yeah.
I love it. Okay, my last question, which is my big James Lipton question of the podcast. You ready?
Okay.
I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to your office here, knocks on the door and says, look, we're all part of the Disney family. I want to thank you for everything you've done for us and for musical theater, and I want to grant you a wish.
I wish for more wishes.
Can't wish for more wishes. Nice try.
Oh, damn it.
What's the one thing about Broadway, or for you, I'll even widen it to the entertainment industry, because you work so often on both coasts now. What's the one thing that drives you so crazy, that makes you angry? You are one of the nicest and sweetest guys I've met and known. When I hear about your collaborative process, I am not surprised, because you're such a nice and genial guy. What makes you mad, keeps you up at night, that you would wish this genie would change in the snap of a finger?
You know, I don't think about that stuff like you're saying. I think if I were to, it's something new that I really never quite felt before, but I think a lot of people have been realizing it lately, and it's just representation. I never realized. I grew up, I'm part Filipino. I was not raised as ethnically different than I was assimilated. You know, I came from an assimilated family, and to me, normal America was a story would be about a white person, and I would change that. I would change, and having daughters and having written Frozen, I learned just from watching the response to that how much my experience as a man has been affected by the white privilege, white male privilege of our society, and that how insidious it is at a very basic level. It's like the lens we see the world through, that of course men run it, of course. It's just, that's the way it is. I would change that. I would want the stories that we see to reflect all the stories that are out there.
It's a great answer. I want to thank you for that answer and congratulate you on all the success. And thank you for taking time out of your very busy, busy day to spend it with us. Ooh, and I'm going to announce our next guest, but we're going to announce it in a little different way. We're going to play a little game. You ready?
Yeah.
Want to play this game?
Love it.
It's the riddle. First of all, I will tell you that all the guests, we are now doing a little 6 degrees of separation. So you are connected to the next guest. Okay. Now finish this riddle. Ready? Here you go. All you out there, you ready for it? He's press repped like 400 Broadway shows, from Book of Mormon to Sunset Boulevard to Anything Goes. Originally from London Town, my next guest is...
Chris Bono?
Adrian Brian Brown. His partner. You're good. Don't worry about it.
I have no idea.
Thank you so much for this, Bobby, and best of luck with Frozen and Frozen 2. Thanks so much for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time. Don't forget, next Wednesday, April 6th, How to Sell Tickets with Social Media, the webinar. 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Get all the information at theproducersperspective.com and join the Producers Perspective Pro, and you can take this webinar for free. I'm gonna be a producer. Look out, Broadway.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.